This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Thomas Green on the 21st of September, year 2001, at approximately 10 o'clock. We're in the Special Collections Library Interview Room in Lubbock, Texas. We are accompanied by John Bernstein, Graduate Research Assistant. Sir, why don't you go ahead and begin by providing some brief biographical information about yourself, when and where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay. I was born in Vineland, New Jersey, August 4th, 1948. Grew up in the same city, went to high school in the same city. I actually never left Vineland until I went to the Army.
Wow.
I mean, not that I never left, but always lived there.
Right.
Graduated Vineland High in 1967. For a brief period of time, attended a little-known school called Salem Tech. Was enrolled in those days in a drafting program, a two-year drafting program. And at some point, I guess during the first or second semester, a friend of mine and I decided life was too short for metallurgy and calculus, and decided to strike out and thought it might be a good idea to join the Army. Probably not one of the brightest decisions I ever made in my life, but it was all mine, so, and that's what we did. And we were, we enlisted out of the, we were processed through the AFI station in Newark and took basic training at Fort Dix in 1968.
Okay. Now, while you were growing up in Vineland, what was it like there? What was the size of that city?
Well, actually, Vineland, from a square miles point of view, was the largest city in New Jersey at 67 square miles. Obviously, you know, in those days, it was a lot of rural farmland. The poultry industry was the predominant business. There was chicken farms everywhere. Matter of fact, our high school, we were the Fighting Klan. So that was the predominant industry. It was either farming or chickens in those days. And it was a great town, really. It was really you could go anywhere, any time of the day or not. I mean, there was no problems. It was really a good place to grow up. As in everything else, everything changes with time. But in those days, it was really great.
Was it ethnically diverse? Did you have like small communities of different?
It was ethnically diverse, and on pretty divided lines almost by street. It had a large Italian neighborhood on one side of the main drag. On the other side of the main drag, between here and here, was a largely Afro-American, and then in those days, it was a small Hispanic influence in the community, which grew over the years and is now probably one of the largest Hispanic populations in southern New Jersey reside right there. Mm-hmm. So it was diverse. It was, don't remember in high school where we had Hispanic, we had white, we had blacks. I don't remember a lot of Oriental or with that influence, you know, the Southeast Asians. Don't remember a lot of those, but clearly, just about everything.
Was there forced busing in the community? Do you remember?
Forced busing did not start to occur in Vineland until the very late 60s. I want to say right after I got out of high school,
Okay. They
got into some of it to because the population was not spread across the school systems properly,
right.
What they felt was the federal guideline or whatever
right.
It became in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really recall. I remember hearing about it, but I believe I was already out of high school in that
group. Okay. And you didn't mention any Irish communities. There wasn't.
Oh, well, there was.
Or the European communities.
There was Irish and Italian and, but was not. I want to say that we didn't really dwell on the in those days in that community. I mean, it was, I don't know, it was just a different time. There was no, in those days, I don't recall racial tensions. I mean, you know, we used to play sports, and there were every black, and we played sports. We hung out together. We didn't, there was not a, was not an issue in most cases, or unfortunately, that wasn't the case all over, but right in that, it never became an issue. I can remember when when I was still in high school, we had a young guy transferring from California, and his family relocated from California. And of course, he came in with, you know, long hair down to the middle of his back, and he was just totally, you know, outside the norm that the guys on the football team used to chase him around with scissors. They were going to cut his hair. It was like a throwback or something. You know, you didn't have a crew cut, you weren't right or something. But, of course, we go back to the same school 5 years later, and it's completely the other way. Right? Mm-hmm. But I don't. We never had any real racial issues, or problems. Our biggest problem was, you know, our rival high school. Every Thanksgiving after the football game, we would fight. It didn't matter if we won or lost, there was a fight. Mm-hmm. A big fight. We did that every year. It was tradition. Even if they weren't mad. We had to do it.
Right. Okay. Do you remember when Kennedy became president? Were you politically
Absolutely.
Aware when you
Yes.
were that young?
Mm-hmm.
Did it have meaning for you as a young person?
Well, I don't know that it had meaning by the fact that he was president. I don't even think I had a recognition, because I would have been in, I was in junior high when he was killed. Ninth grade when he was killed. I don't think I had a recognition politically from the point of view that I understood that he was a Democrat, and, you know, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the differences therein. But I think there was a general understanding about by the young people that he was a young president. He was very charismatic. He was somebody that you listened to him talk, you watched him on television, and you liked. You just liked him because he had that personality. And I remember, I remember, like everybody does, I guess, you know, where I was and what I was doing when we found out he was killed. And that was my first real experience as a young person, where an entire nation just stopped in its tracks for days. I mean, nobody did anything. It was the TV and this thing just unfolded in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very sad time. Probably sadder because we were sad, but probably just didn't really know why we should be sad. But we were sad because this very popular young president that the younger people seemed to relate to an awful lot was killed. I mean, he was assassinated. And that doesn't happen here. Leaders don't get assassinated. They do. He did. So from that point of view, I wouldn't say that I was politically plugged in to John F. Kennedy, but clearly, you know, he was with the younger people. I mean, they seemed to relate to, or I did,
mm-hmm.
I did, we did. But you could relate to him, I think, a little easier.
Yeah. How much do you remember about the Cold War as a young person growing up in the early 60s, going to school?
Well, I can remember, and now that I look back at it, how ludicrous it was going through the, you know, the bomb shelter days, the civil defense drills, the nuclear blast warnings, and I'm talking about, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, like, you know, getting out of your chair and sitting under your desk is going to protect you in a nuclear blast. I don't know, but I remember clearly going through all the drills and all the buildings that were so designated, labeled with the shelter signs, and I remember people in the neighborhood, at least one person, you know, built their own bomb shelter and stocked it, and they were ready to pull their family in and lock the door when it happened. But of course, many people were convinced, and again, I was in junior high during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. But clearly, there was a prevailing feeling among the adults that I think certainly trickled down into the teenagers that we were on the brink of war, and this was a very bad thing that was going on. Mm-hmm. So, it's, I guess, today children would be treated for being traumatized with all the fear of all the exercises they were put through, but it was just like a regular thing. It was like a fire drill. Mm-hmm. We had our civil whatever drills, civil defense drills.
Yeah. Did they call them duck and cover drills when you were getting under your desk and stuff?
I don't remember the term duck and cover, but I remember for one of the drills we had to pull out the chairs, put the chair on top of the desk, and then get under the desk. And then for another one, we had to leave the classroom and sit in the hallway with our back against the wall to be away from all the glass on the exterior of the building. And there were two types of drills. I never, as I got older and started to understand the actual, what a nuclear device actually did, and I don't think, as a fourth grader or third grader, you really fathomed what exactly they were talking about. But once you realize how absurd the drills were. Mm-hmm. Okay, the entire building wouldn't be there. Yeah. So what wall you were sitting against? I must have made everybody else feel better that they were doing something. Yeah. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Did they show you films and stuff?
We did see films of drills, of shelters, of they were checking for radiation, mm-hmm. Geyser cannon, whatever. In order to educate us on what radiation was, what radioactivity was, and why it was dangerous, and what the fallout was. Mm-hmm. I don't think they actually told this bunch of fourth graders anything about what ground zero could be expected to be like, but clearly all around the periphery they gave it to us. Yeah.
And you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. Was that talked about much in your household, in your home?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was the topic of conversation in every household. I had my brother-in-law was career military, and I think at the time he was a captain, or might have still been a lieutenant. And he, at the time, was in charge of a maintenance company that did maintenance on Nike guided missiles. That's his specialty in those days. And he was stationed at the time at the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama. And the family never realized that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was not in Alabama. He was actually on a beach on the panhandle of Florida, where a lot of military was deployed in a defensive type situation. Mm-hmm. So just by the fact that he was in and things were going on, I think my family, my father, my mother, my brother, and obviously my sister, were a little bit more tuned in to what was going on, particularly with the military. But clearly, I mean, I don't think maybe I myself at my age may not have realized how close we really were to the brink of a world war. Mm-hmm. But clearly we realized that there was a lot of inherent danger in what was going on. And the blockade, was a big thing. If they didn't back down on the blockade, then the alternative was not good. Mm-hmm. We had to start sinking ships or whatever. So yeah, it was a pretty tense time.
Mm-hmm. And what is your first memory of Vietnam and the American involvement in Vietnam?
Well, you know, that's funny, because it's funny you should say that. I'm not really sure. I know that 65, 66, while I was still in high school, clearly, you know, we were in Vietnam, and we were starting to get the nightly news was starting to carry more and more of the pictures of what was happening there. And clearly, there's, you know, I remember my senior year, a fellow from our hometown was a KIA, and of course that made all hometown page, of course. So, and that, I think that was my first recollection that really brought the war home to me. I guess because it put a name to these nameless casualties, but so I want to say that 66, 67, my junior and senior year in high school, of course I had a fellow from my home room who was killed in the Marine Corps, not to get off the subject, but in those days, young men that got into trouble with the law, judges did some strange things with the juvenile justice system. This guy got into trouble. He was probably a C or below student to begin with. So the judge gave him a very simple proposition. He said, "Look, I'm going to sentence you 30 days from today. This is a juvenile justice. So if you come back here in 30 days and you have your enlistment papers into one of the branches of our service, that's it. You leave." So if you come back here in 30 days and you have it, I'm going to send you to Jamesburg Reformatory for Boys for a year. Your choice. But what the judge probably thought, he was sending somebody where they would get some discipline, some backup. But what he gave him was a death sentence, because he joined the Marine Corps and within a year he was dead in Vietnam. So that brought it home pretty good. Mm-hmm. That there was really bad things happening. Or could be bad things happening. But you might say to yourself then, why in God's name would you enlist? I don't know. I'm telling you, I don't know the answer to that question either. So yeah. If you're going to ask, I don't know the answer. I'm telling you, I don't know.
Actually, I was wondering what was your family's take on the war as it unfolded, and how was it discussed in your home?
Well, you know, I really don't remember a lot of discussion in my home between my parents and myself or my brother or even between my parents about the war, other than the fact in general terms that, you know, they need to do what they need to do there and get everybody home, was kind of the prevailing feeling. There was never a lot of discussion about it until I came home with enlistment papers in my hand.
Okay.
And I'm probably very responsible for many, many gray hairs in my sainted old mother's head. And this was just one of those occasions.
Okay.
But like I said, I'd gotten out of high school and been in technical school. Decided life was too short for that. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine and I decided, that would probably be a good idea, let's enlist and mm-hmm. see a little bit of the world.
What did your family do, your dad and your mom?
My mom at the time was a licensed nursing home administrator. She had worked as an executive secretary all her life for the administrator of a hospital. And she had this opportunity and interviewed for it. And the outfit that hired her in those days, really took a chance, because she had no direct administrative, you know, she never run a hospital or a nursing home or anything of that size on her own. But they took a chance on her, and actually she did very well with that career. And my father was in sales all his life.
Okay.
He was a salesman.
You mentioned that your uncle was in the service. Did you have any other relatives?
My brother-in-law.
Your brother-in-law was in the service.
Yeah.
Did you have any other uncles,
no.
other relatives that were in the service?
No.
How old was your brother-in-law?
Well, let me see. Now I'm going to have to figure that out. He was a graduate. He graduated, well, it's Widener University now. It used to be Pennsylvania Military College before it became Widener. Mm-hmm. He graduated PMC. I got to figure this out. My sister is 14 years older than me.
Wow. Well, let me simplify it. Did you serve in Korea, do you know?
He did not serve in Korea during the Korean War. Okay. He had tours in Korea, but he was not there. He wasn't that.
Okay.
He was post-Korea. Okay. Did a couple tours in Vietnam.
Okay.
At different times.
Wow.
During, you know, his career. But,
did he serve in Vietnam before you?
Yes, he had done a tour before me.
Did he, when he came back, did he talk to you about it at all?
No, you know what? He, tough duty. He, for a period of time, like for a 10 or 12 year period, was stationed out of Schofield Barracks in Hawaii. And of course, my family's been on the East Coast. We, you know, every couple years, maybe we actually got together and see them. Mm-hmm. Either they came home or we went there. So I didn't have a lot of direct contact. I remember clearly that my mother telling me that when she told him that I had enlisted in the Army, he wrote back and said, "I hope you're talking about the Salvation Army and not the U.S. But I think, that aside, I think that he was also quite proud that, you know, he was just breaking stuff.
Mm-hmm. What was the atmosphere like, say, from the time you graduated high school to the time you enlisted in your community with regard to the war? Was there any anti-war agitation, any anti-war protesting?
Not, I mean, we saw it going on the television, but locally, I don't have any recollection of local protests, you know, either at the high school or college level. I mean, the closest college at the time to you know, to South, I mean, we had at the time we had Glassboro Teachers College, a state college. You had to get to Princeton, you know, to get to a major campus, and it was pretty far. So we didn't have it right in our backyard. I mean, it wasn't in our face. It was on the television.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew clearly that there was, you know, that whole hippie, you know, movement going on,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't necessarily a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Love not war is not a bad premise. It's just got to get it in the right channel.
Yes, sir. That's it. Okay. And when you did decide that you and your buddy decided you were going to go and live a more exciting lifestyle for a little while, why did you choose the Army and not one of the other branches?
Ah, no, that's a very good question. We went to the Navy recruiter. Now the Navy recruiter said that, for example, because we were enlisting, they would guarantee us certain training in very broad areas. Okay, in other words, if I said, look, I want to be trained in electronics, they said, well, okay, you'll be trained with electric. And under electric, there's like 600 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. So that, we didn't deal with that. The Air Force, we went to talk to the Air Force recruiter, and he wanted to, again, probably not, again, not one of my brother-in-law's. He really, his big push was, listen, let us put you back in college. We'll put you on a campus. ROTC, you come out, you graduate an officer, you give us 6 years. All sounded like 10 years was too much to get involved with at that point, so.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, you know. You're 18. You're stupid. The Marine recruiter, we just walked past his door. Didn't even like him. Didn't want to talk to him. And we ended up at the Army recruiter, and I'll never forget the guy's name. He's a Sergeant First Class, Richie.
Mm-hmm.
Nice guy, sit down guys. Let's talk. You know. Mm-hmm. So both of us, ironically, going in, we're interested in the military police.
Mm-hmm.
because we both were thinking of maybe law enforcement careers after we got out of town. And the recruiter said, you don't want to do that. Well, why not? I said, well, there's no rank. You can't get any rank. The fastest rank in the United States Army right now is in aviation. Potential, what we're talking about. So it ended up, to make a very long story, he really kind of talked us into this helicopter crew chief MOS, 67N20. And he signed us up for it, guaranteed it, we're going to go. I don't know how far you want me to get off the subject, but
keep going.
You know, it ended up, in those days, we enlisted 120-day delayed enlistment. So the premise being, you know, you have 120 days, you know, back on the block to kiss all the girls goodbye and do whatever you needed to do and have some fun and burn your oats or whatever. So we were actually scheduled to go in January, the end of January. And he called us the day after Christmas. He called us the 26th of December. And he said to us, look, I've got to go up to the AP station in Newark. It's the next day or the day after. He said, if you guys want to ride up with me, you know, we'll get all that administrative stuff for your enlistment taken care of and put to bed. And on the 28th of January, you can just go ahead and report right directly to Fort Dix. Well, we weren't doing anything. Sure, why not? So up we go. So we go da 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 da. The next thing we know, we're in a room, we've got our hands raised, we're taking the oath. And this sergeant up there, he says, "Okay, gentlemen," he says, "just have a seat. The bus for Dix will be here momentarily." Mm-hmm. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, "Did he say bus for Dix?" We were just totally dumbfounded. So we see the recruiter. He's out in the hallway, and we go and grab him. What did you do? What happened, fellas? I said, "Oh, you took the oath? Oh, man, I don't know. You shouldn't have gone through that step." Well, it ends up, kind of a long story, we end up in some captain's office and explain to him the situation, and he agrees to give us 4 days excess leave from the AFI station to report to Fort Dix 4 days later so that we could get through the holiday, the New Year's holiday. And that's what we did. What we didn't realize was the recruiter fell too short of his quota for December. And in those days, if the recruiter didn't make his, you know, there was somebody else recruiting him. He was back in an active, it was good duty. They didn't want to lose it. So I remember my buddy and I, we went through basic together. We ended up at Fort Rucker together. And then he had an opportunity because of a test score. And I forget which test it was because we took some damn money. But one of his test scores showed he had an aptitude in for something that indicated he would probably make an excellent air traffic controller. So they called him and said, "Do you want to change? You know, we're under an obligation to train you this, but we have this." So he ended up down in Biloxi, Mississippi, being trained as an air traffic controller, and I'm in, obviously, Ozark, Alabama at this point in time, and I'm saying, "Gee, I'm sure glad we enlisted together so, you know, we could hang around." But, you know, he went his way, and I ended up going. But we ended up home on leave together at one point in time, and we went directly to the recruiting office to kill that man. We did. And he wasn't there. His assistant at the time had taken over his job, so we asked what happened to him. So, well, he had had a heart attack and this and that and the other thing. I said, "Well, I got a heart attack. He didn't have a heart, but probably a good thing, because I'm sure we had bodily harm, but I still have a mind." Like,
well, when you first enlisted and went home, what was the response?
From?
Your parents.
Well, when I first enlisted and went home, my mother, I thought she was going to drop dead. my father, he said something like, I told you he's stupid. I don't know. My father was supportive. He was supportive. My mother was terrified. Yeah. I realized much after the fact. She was terrified. Her reaction was in.
Derek, can you please come to the reception area? Derek, can you please come to the reception area?
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
In fact, you can unplug it.
Hers was out of terror.
Thanks.
She was scared.
Yeah.
But she, that was only the beginning of her terror.
Yeah.
I never realized that the year I was in Vietnam that I didn't sleep, she didn't sleep either.
Yeah.
But you don't realize that until you're a parent. You can't deal with that emotion because you don't understand.
Absolutely.
Today I understand, but
Well, when you enlisted, did you realize that more than likely you would be going to Vietnam?
Actually, yeah.
Okay.
I want to say that I probably didn't realize that I would end up going to Vietnam. And you have to understand that from my young hometown, kind of small town point of view, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the day of John Wayne, and these were honorable things to do. You fight for your country. It was a good thing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, other than the fact that, you're going to probably... The danger part of it, the fact that you could get hurt or killed, but I mean the fact that you're serving your country was not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes subsequent people tried to make it a bad thing, but it's still not a bad thing. But it was... It was a hard time in our country. It was a lot of emotions that people didn't understand. We didn't understand, and they didn't understand.
By the time you enlisted and left, of course, there was enough of a span of time there for people that you knew, perhaps in high school, to have graduated, been drafted, gone to Vietnam, and come home. Did you know anybody like that?
I don't know that I actually knew anybody that was drafted, had gone and was home.
Okay.
They may have been there,
mm-hmm.
they may have been drafted,
mm-hmm.
But they weren't there and back.
Okay, so you didn't get to talk
I never
to
actually them. Talked to anybody
okay.
prior to going myself that had gone and come back.
Okay.
Never.
What did you think the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
Well, I thought,
when you enlisted?
Well, when I enlisted, in fact, when I left for Vietnam, I think the whole time I was there, the military did a very good job of telling us and training us, and our belief was that we were that this is where the line had been drawn in the sand. Communist aggression was going no further. We were stopping it right here. This was the end. This we're not and. Quite frankly, that could have been accomplished. The war had been fought in a different frame of mind, if it had been fought more strategically, and if there had been more support for it. I think, and this is just me thinking out loud, I think that the elevated body counts, all the quite frankly, bullshit, public relations, military intelligence stuff that started to get fed to the American people was in an effort to try and draw some more support in for the war and say, hey, yeah, we are winning. We're kicking their ass. Little did they know. Body counts are, you blow up somebody, they're in five pieces, that's five bodies, the way we count them. Yeah, it's not one, that's five. Do that to 10 people, it's almost a battalion you took out. You know what I'm saying? It was ludicrous. But at the time, you're a young man, you're pumped up full of red, white, and blue, and you're ready to go.
Yeah.
I never had never was confronted with the negativity of the book, because obviously the whole time we were in Vietnam, that was filtered out. I mean, you didn't read that in the Stars and Stripes. You didn't hear that on Armed Forces Radio. We had no clue.
Right.
We weren't confronted with it until we got back.
Yeah.
And then it was like, well, it wasn't only like being confronted with it. It was like being hit with a brick when you realized that, you know, you came back, you had served, you survived, you were proud, and about 48 hours after you're back in this country, you realize it's not safe to walk down the street with your uniform. Wow, that's a wake-up call.
Yeah.
That's a wake-up call.
When you enlisted, the coverage that was in the evening news and in the newspapers, what was it like?
It was pretty, I'm going to just say, I think still in those days coming into, even though there was a lot of the draft card burning, there was a lot of that on the news at the same time, and you know who was refusing to go. The news coverage, at least in my recollection, was pretty clinical, pretty so-and-so this, this, blah-blah, resulted in this. There was no real editorializing about the war, or it was just clinical stats, figures, what was going on, and that's pretty much my recollection prior to enlistment for sure, but even during, you know, the early part of enlistment, I didn't see any television in basic trains.
No.
Didn't have time to read a newspaper.
Yeah.
And you know, we would watch, I guess, a little bit of it in the day room or whatever at Fort Rucker. But most of the time, you know, we were so involved in either our training or our own things going on, or you know, finally the free time and doing a couple of beers, that we just weren't. I probably weren't just focused on it as much as maybe we should have been, but you know, it's. I just don't remember. Maybe I don't want to remember, but I don't remember a lot of. It seemed to me while we were in Vietnam in '69 and '70 is when a lot of it really started to blossom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really started. That snowball rolling downhill.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, there was some. I mean, you can recall it, but it was not not a major big deal.
Right. So, why don't you go ahead and describe your introduction into active duty Army and leaving home, going to Fort Dix.
Well, I did. Jesus. I probably was amazed. I didn't think that there was anybody in the world that needed to have explained to them the difference in the use of a toilet and a urinal. Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, and I can remember this so clearly, I remember our drill instructor at basic, as he was giving us kind of this tour of thing, taking us into the latrine and pointing to the toilet and saying, "Gentlemen, that is a defecator, that is a urinator. You do not defecate in the urinator and you do not urinate in the defecator." And I thought to myself, okay, alrighty, I got that. And I think that's probably one of the things that struck me first about the military was that it seemed to me they took everything and stripped it down to its most basic first step and started from there. And in retrospect, looking back at it, of course they had to do that. They have, you know, in those days, they had, on an educational and on an ability standpoint, I mean, they had everything from you have a pulse to people they had drafted out of college because they dropped a few credits. So they had a wide spectrum, and they have to start at the very beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember standing in front of a mirror taking instructions on how to brush my teeth, which I thought I'd been doing pretty well for up to that point. But things like that, it was just absolutely incredible to me that somebody had to be taught this, but there was people that needed to be taught. So, you know, the Army, I mean, you know, the first thing they do is take all your clothes away and give you theirs, you know, shave your head, so everybody looks exactly the same. They strip all identity from you. And start again, and then they start again. They start by tearing you down, and then they start to build you up. And I guess in 99% of the cases, it works pretty well, because at the end of that period of time, you're a pretty self-confident young man that you've just lived through this experience that probably you shouldn't have. And you know, then they pack you off and send you to some advanced training where it's not quite as rigid from a discipline point of view and an in-your-face, but it's still pretty rigid. And in my case, you know, I had 8 weeks of basic training in Fort Rucker for 8 weeks of basic aircraft, and then another 8 weeks of single rotor turbine engine. So, you know, by the time you get done with that, you've survived, you feel pretty good about yourself, you know, you're in pretty good shape now. It's time you can cut some oats. But I ended up, I know that when they cut our orders for Fort Hood, and I remember distinctly the orders read, you know, assignment to such and such a unit for further assignment to a restricted area OS. Well, there was only two restricted areas, OS, and that was Vietnam and Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Restricted because you couldn't take dependent. So when I left Fort Rucker, Alabama, after completing crew chief school, and ended up at Fort Hood, I ended up at a unit out on Gray Army Airfield, which several of us in this group ended up out there. But those two units were completely built. They were at strength. So we got about, I want to say, 40 of us that were Army surplus to that unit. And so we were their detailed troop. 40 guys that were fit for details every day. And the highest ranking guy among us was Spec 5, E5. So he had the job every morning of handing out the assignments. And if you went to Reveille in the morning, and either you were told that you were going to be on KP the following morning, or you had a detail, you know, of the supply or wherever, you were cutting grass or whatever it was. But if you didn't get an assignment, you were good to go until next morning Reveille. And no use for you, nobody wanted to see you. So, a lot of days, I remember them sending the same 10 guys, or 12 guys, it was, and we went up to battalion supply, which was just a huge warehouse filled with boxes. And all the boxes were on one side, and the other wall was empty. And the detail was, they swept the floor in here, which really didn't need to be swept. And we moved all these boxes from this side to that side and restacked them. And then the next morning when we came back, we swept that floor and then moved those. And we did that every day. They were it was just busy work.
Yeah,
it was just
getting out of trouble.
Yeah, exactly. So this this Spec 5 was a boy from the South, Southern boy. So I figured out very quickly, there's got to be a way around this. So I showed up at his squad room one night with a bottle of bourbon. I said, I know you're a boy from the South, you must like bourbon. He said, I love bourbon. I said, well, I'll tell you what, I said, there's going to be a regular supply come to your room, but I don't want to be called any morning from now on. No problem, my man, we have a deal. So I spent the next 30 days on leave, basically. We were at the pool every day or downtown. You had to report in for formation, get checked off, and that was there. Yeah. We're getting a detail. Don't learn to work the system.
Absolutely.
I went home on leave from there, and I want to say it was, I took 9 days leave because the buddy I enlisted with was home on leave, came down orders, he was going to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I went home to see him before he left.
When was that?
I was afraid you're going to ask. I want to say it was in May. June of 68.
Okay.
When I left on leave, I came back. Came back at Great Army Airfield. There was two barracks, a little parade field, and not two barracks. There was a barracks, two floors, mm-hmm. a little parade field, and then a barracks with two floors. And at the back of that little parade field was the mess hall. And you got to remember, Gray Army Airfield used to be Gray Air Force Base, mm-hmm. so it was nothing like the Army. Everything was built with four-man rooms. There was no squad bays like the Army would have done. They'd have opened the whole top floor and put 100 people there. So the living conditions from that at Gray were pretty good, mm-hmm. you know, compared to what we had been used to so far, or I had been used to so far. But anyway, I left. I came back. And the two units that were there chipped while I was gone. Billets was completely empty. I went up to my room, which was on the second floor, down at the end where the rest of the excess baggage was, empty. My footlocker was gone. Everything. My locker was cleaned out. There was nothing there. So I came out. I remember I came outside. And I was still I was in khakis, I was in dress uniform, as I had been traveling. And I looked down at the other building, and I could see a couple people going in and out. I thought, alright. So I walked down there, and I ran directly smack into a first sergeant I'd never met before. And he looked me up and down, and he said, "And what the hell do you want?" And I said, "Well, first song," I said, I went on leave and what? Come in here. He takes me inside the order room. "What's your name?" I give him my name and he looks down and says, "Oh, this is perfect. Your ass is mine." Okay, top. Can you tell me what the hell's going on? Because I don't know. He said, he checked some chart. He says, "Your stuff's been moved to second floor, such and such a room. Get the hell out of that uniform, get your fatigues on, get ready to work." Okay, I get that. So I went up, ran into a buddy of mine who had moved my stuff down for me, got me squared away. He said, "Have you met our first sergeant?" Yeah, I said, "Yeah, I just had the pleasure. Real nice guy." He said, "Yeah, well, wait till you hear the line on him." I said, "Please tell me." Well, First Sergeant Meadows was his name. First Sergeant Meadows was a first sergeant in Korea and lost most of his unit. He was wiped out. He took a battlefield promotion to second lieutenant. Came back, became a first lieutenant, had been a captain, he was an artillery company commander at Fort Hood. Got passed over three times for promotion to major, and they rifted him back to his last permanent rank, to his first sergeant, sent him to our unit to go back to Vietnam, and he was full of attitude.
Oh, wow.
Understandable.
Yeah. But.
So after we got the line on him, you know, everybody kind of, all right. I guess he's got a good way to have the jaws. Mm-hmm. He was nasty. He never mellowed.
Really?
In fact, he had his first sergeant chevrons on his collars, you could see where the squares had been sewn on for his captains and artillery insignia and had been pulled off because it was a different color. He was not a happy.
Yeah.
But anyway, we then we started building those two units, and they were actually supposed to be and G troop, 15th calf.
Okay.
And we started building and training to go beyond that.
Okay. Excuse me, I hate to interrupt, but a few quick questions about your training before the troop was formed and you went to Vietnam. In basic, in particular, how is discipline enforced, usually, by the DIs?
Anything from kick you to slap you to hit you with your own rifle, whatever. They did whatever they wanted.
A lot of push-ups too and stuff like that?
Oh, well, yeah, normal. But I mean, they would...
Also physical stuff.
Oh, yeah. They. My DI was a little Puerto Rican gentleman, and he used to carry a Life magazine rolled, rubber-banded, and I think it was shellacked. I mean, it looked like a magazine until he hit you with it, and then it felt like a nightstick. So whenever anybody bitched, complained, I slapped him with a magazine. Come on. But he had it worked. He had it right. But anyway, yeah, I mean, a lot of push-ups, a lot of running, of course. Whatever they could do.
Did they invoke Vietnam very much?
Yeah. Oh yeah. That was it. You know, everything from maggot, you're so stupid, you're dead on arrival. You're D-O fucking A.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Cheer me up. Yeah. But it was all, you know. I always call it part of the hype. You know?
Yes.
Part of the they did.
Mm-hmm. Were many of them Vietnam veterans?
All.
Okay.
All. Most all of them, combat infantry.
Okay.
Decorated. Mm-hmm. And they were proud, and they had a right to wear proud. Mm-hmm. And they had been there, they had done it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the most part, you know, think about it. They took the training they were giving you serious to the point where they wanted you to be able to save your life. They didn't want you to go over there and get killed. You know, so maybe sometimes that motivated them to be less than patient.
Yeah.
But I'm sure in their mind's eye, that was their motivation. And quite frankly, I don't know that you actually can fault somebody for that type of thing.
Yeah.
But it was everything. Everything was bad. Everything. Basic was Vietnam.
Did they have a mock village set up for you guys to train?
Not in basic.
In fact,
when I went through basic, we were still training in basic with the M14. We didn't have the M16.
Okay.
I never saw the M60. I never qualified on the M16 until I got to Fort Hood.
What did you think about the differences between the two?
Oh, I thought the M16 was far superior in handleability, in recoil and target acquisition, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
14 was heavy, solid weapon, great weapon, but heavy, and the M16 was so much easier to deal with on a personal level, carrying and cleaning. I never much cared for it for the manual of arms. I always thought the 14 was a little smarter.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, it was a great weapon.
Did you ever have one lock up on you in training or in Vietnam?
No. Never had one fail.
Okay.
That was the early AR-15s, I guess. The early ones that came out. My recollection is they were identified by the open end of the flash suppressor. It came out to the point where it wasn't closed. They had a lot of early problems with those.
Okay.
But the ones we had now.
What about your advanced training to become a crew chief? What did they focus on? What were the things?
Crew chief was mostly technical aircraft, very short gunnery portion where we didn't actually fire from an aircraft, but we had to climb up a 50-foot tower and shoot off the tower.
Okay.
And one orientation ride in the damn helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Okay.
You quickly, or I quickly found, once they handed you an aircraft, I think one of the, probably one of the things that startled me at first was, and still does, I guess, in a lot of respects, I mean, if you think about, here's a 19-year-old kid, 20, about 16 weeks of advanced training, and they hand over this aircraft, and they say, go ahead and take care of it, it's yours. Make sure nothing breaks. Make sure everything, check everything. So. And of course the incentive there is, you know you have to fly in it, so you kind of want everything to be working right. But I think back at it now, and I think probably when I was there and it was happening, I was probably very cavalier or non. Didn't even focus on that, but I think about it, yeah, I think that was a lot of responsibility to hand a bunch of kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the pilot, most of the pilots were not much older than us, so it was just, you know, kids leading the kids in a lot of respects.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still doing it today.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing.
Did you feel confident after basic and AIT?
I did feel confident. The problem we had to Arvin qualify at Fort Hood, which was a week-long deal, and it was a series of classrooms, and at the end we actually assaulted an Arvin village. And after you completed that successfully, and recollection was it was some type of test kind of thing, you were stamped Arvin qualified.
Mm.
You're good to go. And I think back on it, the first village I went into, I got blown up looking in the well. So, you know, it was booby trapped and I looked.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I broke a heel off a boot coming into the village.
Mm.
And I had to walk the rest of the day. Things you remember. But, I thought the training was good. I thought it prepared us well for the job we had to do. I don't think anything can prepare you for the horror of what you have to do, though. I don't think there's no amount of training in the world that gets you ready to see what you've never seen before, and to see carnage and people just mutilated, it's, I don't know how you prepare somebody for that. I mean, I think they could have done a much, much better job on the return end than they did. You know, I think there should have been a lot of, especially either for guys who were discharging right out, there should have been, post-Vietnam counseling provided. And certainly those that still had time came back. There should have been some type of formalized, session that they put those guys. I think ultimately, at the end result, the DA and the entire federal government would have saved themselves millions and millions of dollars by doing it on the front end rather than waiting for the post-traumatic stuff to kick in and start taking its toll.
Mm-hmm.
But it's retrospect.
Yes, sir. Well, we've been talking for an hour. Let's take a quick break.
All right.
So when you got back from leave and went to what would become your final unit before going to Vietnam and training with them, how much time did you spend with them here in the United States before shipping to Vietnam, and how much training did you do?
Well, actually, we formed up pretty quick. The units became full pretty quick. So I want to say that this was in June. By September, maybe earlier, maybe August. By August or September, we were in the field training 4 to 5 days every week, straight through till February the following year. February of 69.
Wow. Okay. Now, during that period, and even before, I guess, when you were in training, had you heard about the Tet Offensive of 68?
I remember hearing about the Tet Offensive, but I don't know that it was before or after.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also, how about the President Johnson's decision not to run for re-election? Do you remember hearing about that? And while you that would have been about the time you went on leave, in May of 68, I guess. It was in March. But it would have been tough.
I probably heard it, but attached no particular significance to it at the time.
Okay.
Because I got to tell you that we were pretty narrowly focused at that point in time. Our lives were, when I mean Ford, we packed up right after chow on Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
We moved our entire troops into the field,
mm-hmm.
set up tents, and we lived out there until late on Thursday or early on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
When we came back, we had everything to clean, get ready, and then we had to stand a full barracks inspection by the bunk on Saturday morning and pass, and if all went well, with any luck at all, we didn't have to redo anything on Saturday night. We got off Saturday night and had Sunday to relax, and then we went back and did it again on Monday. We did that every week for months.
Wow.
And again, we were considered to be, at that time, on 12-hour days to accustom us to what we would be dealing with once we got in the country.
Yeah. How effective was that?
It was sucked. I was no more accustomed to it when we started doing it in country than I was when we started doing it in Texas. I'm just more tired. I don't think it worked at all. But,
okay.
But clearly, you know, we were in a heightened training mode. There's no doubt about that. I mean, right to, you know, we'd be set up in a field and get a sapper attack and break everything down, loaded into aircraft and move in the middle of the night.
So you got a little flight time.
Oh yeah, we were flying all day. And it was just like pretty much like in country operations, but in the field at.
Mm-hmm.
At Hood. So in that respect, it was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at some point in time we had to run the night infiltration course, which was designed to get everybody captured,
mm-hmm.
make them prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
Where they were brought back to a camp. The professional interrogator that was being used at the time was a former Korean communist interrogator that had come over since the war. And
mm-hmm.
He was quite effective. Quite effective. I, fortunately, because of my the fact that I was the crew chief for the troop commander, he saw fit to allow me to stand crew chief for the medical helicopter for both nights of the infiltration. So I unfortunately missed being made a prisoner of war myself,
mm-hmm.
but I sure watched a lot of other people go through. But
mm-hmm.
look at the draw, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. How much range time did you get during that heightened training period?
Very little, very little.
Any live fire exercises?
Very little. We requalified with 16. We got no live fire on 60s,
okay.
which we probably should have had.
Mm-hmm.
We should have had some live fire. Well, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that. We got a lot of range time with the Cobras.
Mm.
They did a lot of live fire on the Cobra range with the Cobras. But with personal weapons mm-hmm. and with the M60s that the door gunners and crew chiefs would be handling, they'd have been, I think, smart to arrange some live fire downrange for us also.
Yeah.
But we did zero.
That's interesting. What when you first were assigned to a helicopter during this training cycle, were you a crew chief, a gunner?
Crew chief.
You immediately went up to a crew chief?
Well, I was a crew chief because I was trained that way, and a crew chief automatically becomes the door gunner on the right side.
Right.
So
yeah.
You know, it's a dual function.
Sure.
When we got into country, and I don't want to jump ahead because there's still a hood, but I ended up with a leftover from the B Troop 2nd and 17th Cavalry was there, and it was a squadron of armored personnel carrier. So I ended up with a sergeant that was left over from that. He was an APC commander, and they gave him to me as a door gunner because he had a couple 3 months left to do in country before his hitch was up. But he didn't know, you know, tail rotor from PDOT tube, so for aircraft, well, he couldn't help. So he handled the guns, and I handled the aircraft. I mean, as far as cleaning and taking care of it, he took care of both machine guns, and I took the. He didn't have to help me with the aircraft at all.
Okay. And do you remember code of conduct training?
I remember code of conduct training, absolutely.
And did that, was it consistent from basic to AIT and into training, for instance, like when you were in the POW
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Matter of fact, the entire, it seemed to me, now that you mentioned it, it seemed to me that the entire interrogation process, the entire prisoner process they were putting through was a test of the code of conduct and how well it was going to be held up. In reality, is the code of conduct archaic and unreal in certain set of situations? Not in principle, but in practice, I think it's very tough. Mm-hmm. And not that you're going to give up any secrets either, but that.
Understood. Well, throughout the training from May until February of 69, May 68 to February 69. Was First Sergeant Meadows still with you?
Yeah, he went to Vietnam.
He did go to Vietnam. Did he ever mellow a bit?
No.
Okay.
No, he, when, and he transferred out, May, we were in Tennessee. I'd say he transferred out of our unit, I want to say, might have been the end of June.
Okay.
After we had come to
during that heightened training period, how confident did you become in the become with the leadership of the unit, the lieutenants, the captains, the whole officer corps?
Well, you know, I can probably answer that now retrospectively, but I'm not sure that I made an assessment at the time. Leadership. I knew that I felt that we had some real solid NCOs in the outfit. I mean, you know, some old dogs that were teaching the young puppies their tricks. And I think that when you looked at the troop commander who I flew with every day. I clearly thought that at that point in time that this guy's pretty much together. He knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
We had some great officers stateside, but you have to remember that the majority of the pilots that we had were W01s right out of school, and we were just about all the same age. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, save for different direction out of basic, one could have been interchanged with the other.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, most of them were down to earth type kind of guys. I mean, they almost, you could almost get the perception that some of them felt uncomfortable being saluted. That type of thing. And aviation units, cab units, or even aviation, you know, in that flight line environment and that aircraft environment, it becomes a little looser. You can say and do things in those type of units with your officers that you would never dare in some other type of unit. Because the pilots know they're dependent on you and you're dependent on them, and you know, you have to have confidence in each other. So it kind of makes a pretty tight bond, is the best way I can describe it. But I don't really think, I don't have a recollection of making us, except for the, you know, you always have one or two that particularly stand out as being less than wonderful people. I refrain from using the term asshole, but there was several through the but I mean, you know, you run into it. But by and large, the majority of the warrant officers, the commissioned officers, by and large, thought they were professional, well trained. I never got in an aircraft and flew with anybody that I didn't believe was a pretty damn good pilot. Mm-hmm. Not when I was with this unit. Airplane transfer is a different story, though. That's kind of stuff.
When you, why don't you go ahead and describe when you actually left the trip over and your first impressions of arriving in Vietnam?
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's important that you understand that we were originally supposed to be FNG Troop 15th CAF. And we had a rate of desertion from those two units that caused almost a congressional investigation. And there is some old literature, some of the papers of the time that covered the story. So what happened, because there was going to be a congressional inquiry into this, the Army said, don't worry about it, Congress, we've disbanded the units, they no longer exist. We've scattered those people, they're gone. When in fact, FNG Troop 15th CAV became B and C Packet 17th CAV, which ultimately became B and C Troop 2nd and 17th CAV. So that's just a little interesting sidebar that should not be lost in here.
Mm-hmm. Well, what caused those high desertion rates?
Well, I think it was the level of training. I think probably it was intense. I mean, it was a bitch. It really was a bitch. I mean, it was good. In retrospectively, it was good. I mean, it prepared us, but it was a bitch. I mean, there was just nothing to look forward to. Yeah. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So between that and the fact that, you know, as the months wore on, and I think, you know, shipment date was obviously out there looming, I think there was guys that just said, you know, well, I'm going into town and grab my bus and go my way, and that's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately we became B Troop 2nd and 17th, March of 69, as the Army always does at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning, they kicked us awake. We had been locked down on base for 30 days. The NCOs were locked on, everybody was locked on, nobody could get off. All our stateside clothes and stateside uniforms were shipped home. They took us over to Main Post, we packed everything up, put it in a box and shipped it home to Mom and Dad. So the only thing we had was jungle fatigues and our field gear. So obviously, even if you got off gray, MV and that be a rocket scientist, all you had to do was see the jungle fatigues walking down the street, and they'd pick you up right away. So they locked us down about 30 days out, and then, like, whatever day that was in March, they kicked us out of bed. And there was buses outside waiting for us, and on the buses we got, and I remember a rather stirring speech by the 55th Aviation Battalion Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Bristow, I believe was his name. Nice man.
Mm-hmm.
Came on the bus, he was a very religious man, came on the bus, and he was talking to all of us, and kind of trying to wish us well, and I remember he said, in our bus, he said something to the lines that, I know that many of you men will not come home. It's a glorious thing you do for your God. And he got off the bus. And I remember looking at whoever was sitting next to me and I said, what did he say? it's a glorious thing we're doing for what? Who? What? We're not what? I mean, because you're half awake. And it's, and you think, did I really hear him say that? Holy Christ! That was the send-off, and they drove us right from there to an Air Force base. I want to say it was in Austin, Texas, but I'm not sure it was in Austin, Texas. I don't know where the hell it was, but it was an Air Force base somewhere. They drove the bus right up to the stairway of a 707, Saturn Airways. It was little known. I think they had two damn planes. They were just running a charter contract service for the government. Opened the doorways of the bus, read off the manifest, and checked us into the plane one at a time, and off we went. I probably shouldn't tell you this. We landed in San Francisco because we were on a commercial charter. We had to deplane to refuel. Mm-hmm. FAA regulations. Mm-hmm. Military didn't let you stay on the plane. So I got to a phone and I got a call, which we weren't supposed to do. I probably shouldn't be telling you. I got a call to my mom at her office to tell her that, and the other thing I said was, you know, we're on our way. Next stop is Honolulu. So she called my brother-in-law and sister in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. He, because he was in the military, got a hold of somebody who had the manifest flights coming in that had that. The only one was the Saturn Airways at such and such a time. So he met the plane.
Cool.
He and my sister met the plane. So we're off in the airport at Honolulu having a Mai Tai. Standing at the bar, the three of us having a Mai Tai. And the troop commander, our troop commander, is another major, uh-huh. comes over and says, Green, he's like, I said, oh, I'm sorry, sir. I said, Major Morris, I said, like, you meet Major Pierce, Major Morris. I said, this major is my brother-in-law. Oh, say it back. Pierce is looking at him saying, Major, he said, just exactly how did you know you saw your brother-in-law was coming through today? Oh, I said, Major, he says, he gave him some hint that, you know, that he had something to do with the manifest flights for all incoming, outgoing flights. You know, he gave him some old budget bullshit. I saw the manifest. I knew right away. I said, oh, Christ, I'm going to be court-martialed before I get there. So that was kind of neat.
This is your commander, troop commander, was Fred Pierce?
Fred Pierce.
Okay.
So we then we went on. What's the next stop? Wake Island? I don't know. Wake Island, William Island, mm-hmm. and then from there on into Da Nang, I guess. Mm-hmm. We got there at night or late in the day. It was turning dusk, and my first recollection of landing in country when they opened the door was the onrushing heat, humidity, and smell. I remember sitting in the plane, they opened the doors in preparation because it was just old roll up steps, not like they had a terminal. When they opened that door, heat and humidity, it was so overwhelming, it just almost took your breath away. And then, of course, the god awful odor of that country. I didn't realize what it was at the time, but everybody's burning shit, so that's kind of weird. And they put us on some trucks, and they took us to an area that they were going to bed us down for the night. And as they're walking us down to where we're going to be, these hooches we're going to be building, they're pointing out bunkers. And giving us instruction that if there's an attack or anything happens, you must get to your assigned bunker. Like any bunker won't do, you have to be in the same bunker. But I guess, there's... So we got an uneasy night's sleep, and first thing the next morning, we're up, and they're taking us down to the mess hall, and we're standing in line. Of course, we're standing in line with some of the permanent party there in this area. I remember one guy talking to the other, and he says, we're going to get hit this morning, no doubt. And I says, the KPs didn't show up this morning because they used civilian labor. These Vietnamese labor is going to be. He said, they'll be coming in any time now. Well, he no sooner got it out of his mouth. I don't remember to this day whether it was a mortar attack or a rocket attack, but shit started exploding. And we started running. And of course, now you got to get to your assigned bunker. I actually ended up in my assigned bunker, and I still had an egg on my plate. I took my plate. I don't know why. I had the tray, and it still had an egg on. I had nothing to eat it, but I still had an egg on. And we got into the assigned bunker, and that was our welcome. That was their intelligence had brand new units in country overnight, so that was our welcome. Mm-hmm. It was, I guess, their way of saying welcome, boys.
Yep.
From there, we flew up. I guess we flew up or drove up maybe, to Eagle. Mm-hmm. We got to Camp Eagle, and I think our aircraft was still 2.5 or 3 weeks behind us because they were coming by ship. So we spent the first several weeks in country, filling sandbags, bagging hooches, which was a relatively new area that had been built for us, getting it ready for the aircraft to come in. And then we went down. Remember, it was a long drive, I know that. We went down, they flew us down, and then we had to convoy our trucks and all our motorized equipment back while they were still in the process of offloading, and the aircraft were cocooned. They used to stack the tail rotors across the top and wrap it in. It's a big spray cocoon they put around it. So they had to be broken down and set up and get ready to go. We convoyed the vehicles back, and I remember I was riding shotgun on the quarter ton, and the question came up, what happens if you break down? And the answer was, well, we have one tow truck, so, what if somebody's already being towed? You wait until we get somebody back to you. That's a promising prospect.
Mm-hmm.
But we made it up for it.
Were you? Did you carry your own weapons over, or were you issued weapons when you arrived in country?
Our weapons came with us.
Okay.
Yeah, all our weapons were packed and shipped out ahead of us. They were there. They must have come with air, because they didn't go with the. They were there. So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt. One last question about your trip over there. What was the atmosphere like on the aircraft, on the plane, over?
I want to say that through the Texas to San Francisco, San Francisco to Honolulu leg, it was kind of light, joking around, funning around. It seemed to me that, of course, we were probably getting tired as hell, too. It was a long flight.
Yeah.
As we were getting into, and I think it was Wake Island, it was more reserved. By the time we landed in Vietnam, I didn't give a shit what was going on. I just wanted to get out of that plane. I felt crippled. I felt 21 hours or whatever the hell it was. It was just, let me out. I don't care. I don't care if they're shooting, just let me out. And I think everybody was in the same mode or mood by that time. But clearly, I think we were all probably eyes wide open, young men in a very strange and dangerous environment from our perception, and didn't know what to expect next, didn't know what was going to happen when, and very wary about everything around us. And, well, we should have been.
Yeah. the first few weeks that you were at Camp Eagle before you got your aircraft in the first week or however long that lasted, mm-hmm. did the camp ever get hit?
We had at one point we had some incoming rockets which did not land close to our area, but they did land inside the camp, and they had a probe. I remember they had a probe at the wire, and one of the units up the way, the bunker line had shot up some people in the wire. So they sent a lift ship out to get these people, and one of them was, I'd say, barely, but still alive. And I remember when we ran up, because the aircraft was coming into land, so we ran up this hill to the helipad to see what was going on. And I remember the crew chief and the door gunner on the ship that went out to get him. This Vietnamese was still alive, and they kind of grabbed him on each side and just threw him out of the aircraft. And face down, he skid across that PSP and came to a stop, and you know, he was still moving, he was still alive. And I thought to myself, holy Christ! You know, some of the things that you see. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't imagine, I mean, at that point in time, I could not understand. 3 months from then, probably put in the same position, I'd have done the same thing. Just because you are that angry and by that time, it only takes a couple months to really, maybe even a month, you know, when you start to harden in pretty tight. Mm-hmm. It's a shame, but I could see it happening.
What kind of briefings did you get when you arrived in country? Any kind of briefing at all?
You know what? We probably did, but I'd be damned if I remember. I'm sure we were being given spoon-fed or not even spoon-fed, but I'm sure we were given information quite regularly, but I don't remember any, the same old bullshit about taking your malaria tablets and, which is, don't drink the water, don't do this. We'll play with the local girls, whatever. All that normal good advice that they give you. But briefings on operations, what we were doing on a particular day. I probably had more information than most of the guys because I was in the CNC aircraft, so I was hearing it come across, but most of the time while we were out and you have to understand that it's it almost, you learn to live with sleep deprivation after a while, because we crew chief used to be on the pad before sun up, before the sun came up, getting the aircraft ready. Generally we broke ground at first light. We flew all day. We came back at dusk. Crew chief had another hour and a half work to do to button up and get ready for the next day. And then you tried to get a few hours sleep in between, a miscellaneous cleaning the weapon or drinking a hot can of beer when you could find it. Mm-hmm. And you did that 7 days a week, every week. You get to the point where you're just running on empty all the time. You're on autopilot. You're operating, but I don't know that there's a lot of recognition, thought process into what you're doing after a while. At least that's the way it was for me. We did that every day. Now, the slip guys, like Dave, a lot of times they would have a lot of downtime. Mm-hmm. Because if they weren't, if there wasn't an insertion or an extraction, mm-hmm. they were basically, you know, in a standby mode.
Yep.
But, you know, the CNC aircraft, the Loaches and the Cobras, they were out all day. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, but not all of them, but
right.
there was always, you know, a hunter-killer team out that they'd have a Loach and two Cobras, and they'd be trying to take some fire from the ground so they can roll the Cobras in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically what we did. If you think about the, what we did was take a little bitty aircraft and put it so close to the trees snooping around that Charlie just couldn't help but to goddamn take a shot at it.
Yep.
Then as soon as he did, these two Cobras would come in and rain death on the area. And then when they got done raining death, we would try and find an LZ to put the blues in so we could go in and count whatever it was we killed and radio it back. So, I mean, that was the entire... That was every day, just a matter of what AO, what area you were operating in. It gets to be, you know, you start, you know, you have those, you start rolling in Loaches, they start getting hit, you just, we were on an adrenaline pump out there most of the time. Where other guys... They had their adrenaline pumps, but it was in 30-minute windows. We were like all the time, you're tense and you know what's coming next. So it takes a toll on you, bro. You get really, really tired. You really do. You're functioning and you're doing okay, but there's not a lot of thought process. There's not a lot of recognition. I mean, they could have held a formation and you know. Given a lot of information, and I'd have probably been standing there and you know, just, because I'd have been thinking, you know, I got two guns to clean or this and that. I'm thinking about that's the way it was tough business, you know, it really was.
How was morale in the unit?
I think morale was good. I mean, considering we were pretty much exhausted and scared to death. When we got down to Chulai, when the unit got called down to Chulai to back up America, we were in Chulai. We were based on the ass end of a Phantom base, a Marine Phantom base. We were on the slow side of it, and we would fly to Tam Key, which was a staging area for us to work operations out of. So we'd take all our aircraft out there at first light and run operations from there. And it was just absolutely horrendous. It was nonstop. It just never stopped. We were going all the time.
Speaking of the AmeriCal, did you guys receive any briefings on the rules of engagement, law of warfare, things like that, especially with the Cali incident as it unfolded?
Well, you know, we had, and my recollection on this is a little vague, but I know that our leaders had maps that were marked. We had areas in the area of operation where we had free fire zone, we had limited fire zone, we needed some higher authority, we had no fire zone. No one in an aircraft fired unless the aircraft commander told you were clear. The day we were in operations, the day Doc LaPointe got killed, I got shot down. We got shot down. It was a bad. I mean, we put those guys into bad. They were in a crossfire from the time they jumped out of the aircraft. They were there. It was hot. And I was flying. Gary Dolan, Major Dolan, he was the troop commander at that time. And I requested to put some fire on the ground. And he rightly so, ordered us not to fire. The Viet Cong were in such close proximity to our own troops that it would have been a hair. His concern was that we were going to fire down on our own guys by accident. And that's always a possibility. When you're flying in a moving aircraft, like you got a B model, so you got an M60. It's not even on a fixed mount. It's on a bungee cord here.
Oh, man.
It's not easy. But no. They were immediately on the ground, and they were calling up wounded and dead. So we made a low pass, I want to say it was about 110 knots and maybe 400 or 500 feet, and we were taking a lot of fire from the ground, a lot of tracers coming up. Could feel the hits in the ass end of the aircraft, and I told him we were taking fire. I happened to have a door gunner. It was his first time he ever flew, let alone anything else, and they were on one side of a little ridge, and they were down in this little valley, this little hilly area, and we made the pass down the valley and then came up over the hill, and we were coming around, and when he made his second pass over the area, because Dolan was beside himself, he had troops on the ground that were hitting, and I think at that point there probably was a little panic, controlled panic, because he really didn't know how to get him out of it. They were in there, and basically, until they got some additional ground troops in there, they were on their own. They had to, I mean, they couldn't even call an artillery, an airstrike. They were just so close to each other. But at any rate, we made another pass, and the second pass was a little lower and a little slower. And again, we're taking a lot of fire. I called that into him, and he said to me, "I know some, but we got people being hurt. We got to see what's going on." I said, "Okay, fine. On the third pass, and I remember, it's funny, you know, how your memory does strange things. I remember thinking to myself as we came over for the third pass, I said, "Man, three strikes, you're out, and everybody's balking. Jesus Christ, I can't believe he's doing this again." But he did it a little lower and a little slower. Well, and I guess this time it was too much. Somebody ripped the canvas off a 51 cal on the ground and plugged us, but good. And the floorboard next to me exploded up like this. And we had a second lieutenant. His name was Pepper. He was the artillery observer sitting between myself and the other door gunner. And as soon as that exploded, he went just forward like that against the radio console. And he was hit bad. He took a 51 cal in the ass. He was hit bad. So the door gunner, we also took some shrapnel, I think, from the breakthrough. And we had fuel from the fuel cell running into the compartment, and it was coming out and trailing down the doors and going back past the hot end of the engine. Which, I don't know why it didn't go. But the door gunner, who didn't have much experience flying, he looked out the door, and what was happening, that fuel, as it was going past the hot end, and the engine was vaporizing. So he called it that we were trailing smoke. Well, the one thing that they cover with you over and over when you're going through helicopter school is that the decking below you is honeycomb magnesium. And once it starts to burn, you're a crispy critter pretty damn quick. So, taking this, I look out the door and take on my side, and I said to Dolan on the intercom, I said, "It's vaporizing. We're not trailing smoke," because I had unhooked. I was ready to jump out the door. It's going to blow me out the door. I don't want to be a crispy critter. So, but we were, at that point, we had been hit so bad that we had lost transmission fluid, we were losing power in the engine, and he barely had enough RPM on the main rotor to do a good auto rotation, although he did a hell of a job. We smacked in pretty hard, but he broke it enough that, you know, it wasn't, an injury type crash situation. It was kind of just controlled chaos. So we hit on the other side of the hill. We're down in this paddy. You have to remember, pilots can't get out. They can't get out. even if they get the door open, they got this chicken plate that slides in front of them on the side here to prevent. So you got to get them out. So I got out and got the major out, and poor door cutter. He was still in his monkey harness that was attached to a ring, and in his panic, in his poor bastard, he jumped out of the aircraft, and he got to, the only way I can describe it is like a dog that gets to the end of his chain, but is still trying to run, you know? So I got around on the other side, and I told him to stop, and I reached, and it's just one ring. It just snaps and locks. You just pull it, and you walk right out of the harness. So then, by the time I got him out, the co-pilot, a guy by the name of Marv Dixon, he was in a panic trying to get his own thing back because he wanted to get out, you know. He didn't know whether we were still smoking or we had a... So we got him out. So about the time we got a bandage on Pepper, we looked up and there was a dust-off ship right behind us to pick him up. We loaded Pepper out. We set up, it's crew chief's responsibility to set up the perimeter of the aircraft for security. So I set that, and all 200-300 yards on the other side, there was a little hooch. There were some people moving around out there. Didn't necessarily know that they were unfriendly, that they were just villagers. But I said, I pointed it out to Dolan, and I said, you want me to take out the M79 and, you know, throw a couple rounds out over there? And I remember he said, son, he said, let's not do that right now. He said, I think we've pissed these people off enough for one day. I said, okay, sir. He says, let's just, if they come a calling, we'll deal with it. I said, okay. So we waited for the recovery team to come in and rig the aircraft and pull it out, and then the next ship came and pulled us out. And we were gone.
How was that artillery officer?
He lived. He lived, at least, I know that sometime within the next week, Dolan and another officer, or several officers, went to see him at the evac hospital. He had lived. He told me that a good hunk of that 51 cal round came up, like through the right cheek of his ass and stopped up. He got hit bad, but he lived, and I guess that's a good thing. But I thought he was dead as soon as he hit the console, because he just collapsed. So we stopped, we recovered the aircraft, we got it back, and I know myself and somebody else, we started counting, and I think we started at the tail rotor moving forward, and I think in the tail boom, we got up to about 100 holes, and we stopped counting. We'd taken a lot of fire.
Yeah. Now this was out of Camp Eagle, or is that out of Chula?
Chula, we were flying out of Camp Kidman.
When was that?
June 2nd, 1969. Okay.
And you guys didn't jump back into a command and control ship, get back out there?
Yeah, we did.
You did?
Yeah. Okay. We he moved command and control to the site. We had two B models. We moved the radio packs over to that. I got the my B model replaced by a C model. Got that, he moved the CNC package back over to the C model, and then we started flying again. And then I got, I'm going to say in August, beginning of August, I got infused out. So they had to, because we all arrived on the same day, during the course of that year, they had to infuse people out and intermix to get the separation dates spread. You don't have a whole unit that rotates at the same day. So I got sent up to Camp Evans to A Company 158 Aviation,
okay,
which was just strictly a lift company, 20 lift ships. That's all they did.
but back to when the events surrounding when Doc LaPointe was killed. Mm-hmm. When you guys got recovered, were they simultaneously recovering the guy
yes.
that got...
Yes, okay. Well, yeah.
Okay.
It all, they had... they had gotten the... They were in the process of extracting them, or mm-hmm. they were in the process of reinforcing them while we were on the ground.
Okay.
So they were actually being extracted, I think, almost simultaneously with us, okay. or just shortly after.
So when you, after you got back from your recovery, you guys didn't jump back in a ship immediately and go back out there to see what was happening?
No, because they were back. They were okay. back. And, you know, the wounded were... Yeah. were at the evac hospital, and the dead were at Graves Registry. Yeah.
How many guys were lost?
I want to say there was three that day that were dead. And I don't know, there was four or five guys wounded.
Yeah.
It was a tough day.
Yeah. Did you ever find out what unit you were going up against in that area?
You know what, we may have, but I don't recall what it is. Mm-hmm. I know that the guys went back. Hmm. Some of the guys went back to the exact spot where all this happened.
Yeah.
Took Doc's widow with him.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can do that.
Were you briefed on what units you might encounter when you're going on missions? That we're suspecting NVA or we're suspecting VC or anything like
well,
that?
Well, the only thing that I ever recall was that we identified whether we were dealing with VC or we had NVA regulars.
Okay.
And obviously, when you encountered NVA regulars, it brought the sense of urgency to a little different plane.
Mm-hmm.
Why, I don't know. Because I think the little fellows in black pajamas did a fine job mm-hmm. with what they had to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, from their point of view.
Yeah.
But clearly, when you saw the uniformed regulars, it had your attention. Well, I guess because of the potential, you didn't know what you had down there.
Yeah.
Did you have a squad, a unit, a battalion,
yeah.
a division?
Yeah.
You didn't know.
How about equipment? I mean, the NVA were probably better equipped than the VC.
Well, the NVA, they would be better equipped.
Yeah.
But like I said, I mean, the lack of equipment and sophisticated weaponry, you know, didn't really seem to be a major deficit to their jungle tactics.
Yeah.
They run, hid, gotten holes with the best of them. You see some of their bunker complexes, they dig into the side of it. You can bomb it all day.
Mm-hmm.
And just as soon as it stops, your heads start coming out. It's absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about it, it's absolutely incredible.
Okay. This will end interview number one with Mr. Thomas Crane. Thank you very much, sir.